very special privilege to welcome to the podium this morning as our first speaker, Mr. Alex Ross. We've had the privilege of getting to know him over the last 2 years and found him to be an extremely energetic, cogent, a wordsmith, an individual who can describe situations and can encapsulate thoughts. He is the Director of Partnerships in the Office of the Director General of the World Health Organization. He has brought to that office a tremendous stature. He has made partnerships, he builds bridges, and you'll hear, as you hear him speak, the inviting, winsome, yet gently firm way in which he conducts his portfolio. Alex, we're deeply honored that you've come here to be with us today, and we're also deeply grateful that you played a major role in allowing this conference to take place and for us to be hosted in your wonderful headquarters. I present you Alex Ross and thank him for being here.
Good morning. I feel like I'm back at home. I went to school at a university not too far from Loma Linda by UCLA, and this reminds me a lot of my student days, so I feel I'm maybe regressing here a bit. But on the other hand, I'm also deeply humbled by the fact that there are so many of you from so many parts around the world. I mean, 90 to 100 countries. It's not every day that we have that kind of breadth of diversity and representation from activities and actions and your commitments to the communities in which you serve. It is really quite something, and I think it's always humbling when you work in a large organization. I used to work for the U.S. government in the same way, is that how you really try to connect with people, and I think that's the most important thing of all. For we collectively, as various institutions, various missions, various responsibilities, that's really what we're all about. I've also been warned that you are probably the greatest taskmasters on time that has ever been met. So I'm going to really keep to time. I have, I think, about a half an hour. I'm going to cover about three different areas in the talk. One is a quick overview about WHO, because I think when one talks about partnership, it's really trying to understand each other fundamentally. And we come from very different worlds. And so I think not only I'm an American, obviously, I'm born Canadian, and grew up in France. So I do kind of represent a little bit of the international world in myself. But at the same time, WHO is also an institution based of many, many different cultures and nationalities and in some cases also professional backgrounds. And we relish in that diversity and we have a common mission. But I'm going to talk a little bit about WHO. I'm going to say just a few words about health in general because of the context in which this sits. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about partnership and partnering and what some of the issues and challenges that could be there. This hopefully then begins to be a bit of a framework for the meeting that you are quite in the middle of at the moment. A little bit about WHO. Forgive me if some of this is somewhat basic, but I think it's important that we have sort of a common platform. Very simply, WHO, the World Health Organization, is a specialized agency of the United Nations, came into being in 1948. And has 193 member states. The word specialized is important because when you think of WHO, member states in particular treat it in a special way, not just because they feel like they own us, and they do. We are a member state organization, as was mentioned on Monday. But it means also that we are as neutral as you're going to find in the landscape of institutions in health in a developing country. Imagine many bilateral donors, each with a certain agenda. NGOs have agendas. They may be very positive, but they are nevertheless agendas. And the member states need to feel like they have a confidant near them for which, in a sense, that they belong to. And that essentially is one of the major assets that WHO brings, because remember that we are not a financial donor, but we do bring that special both technical skill but also a political role, if you will, in the countries. Specialized also means in the UN world that we don't report to the UN General Assembly. That's a political fact that just kind of keep in the back of your mind. We report to the World Health Assembly, same member states, but a different community. In our case, it's the Ministries of Health rather than the Ministries of Foreign Affairs. In terms of our mission, I mean, I think the two major aspects that you've heard of over and over again, but it helps set the context. The one is that we really are aiming to have the attainment of people's of the highest possible level of health. This has a lot to do with equity, and you're hearing a lot about equity these days. I mean, we do live in an unequal world and an unjust world often, and in that respect, there's a lot of discussions around human rights, but the other side of it is reality. You know, when resources are limited, we are trying to strive that countries make decisions for themselves about how they can get to universal coverage and kind of balance the various competing demands. And the health in our constitution is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. And that's a very broad definition, but it's not also not merely the absence of disease. Now, in 1948, this was quite a forward-looking definition because the not merely the absence of disease really puts the emphasis on prevention and health promotion, but also a more of a larger social interaction. Most recently, as you've already heard, the Commission on Social Determinants. We also live in a world of goals and objectives and things that are quantifiable, and none more important these days in the discourse internationally is the Millennium Development Goals. You've heard this. Now, what does it mean? There are a lot of indicators. Three of the eight are specific to health: child mortality, maternal health, maternal mortality reduction, and HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, notably tuberculosis, neglected tropical diseases. There are some indicators for reproductive health, but there are a lot of other issues that are not part of this. But the other aspect is that it's not just health, it's poverty, it's education, it's climate change, and there are goals there as well. But that language is important to be familiar with, because when you're in a country working internationally, the jargon, the language of negotiation at country levels between UN agencies, between the countries and the UN and the bilateral donors, often uses this language, the code words of Millennium Development Goals and the objectives, and what are they trying to do to achieve those becomes then where the rubber hits the road. WHO, like other institutions, has various frameworks. This is very important because this is a sort of our 10-year plan, but if you look at the breadth simply of the issues, they're quite large. This is not just for WHO. This is a kind of a statement to the world to say you really need to think about health in a broader way. Poverty, health security, which is really around communicable diseases, universal coverage, human rights, the determinants. These are the themes that you've heard already this week, and it continue. Now, this has already been discussed since 2006. And ultimately, governance and leadership accountability. It's quite broad, but it's always helpful to know and give you some comfort of what you're doing fits into kind of a bigger puzzle. Now, WHO as an institution, as I mentioned, is not a financing institution. But what it does do is does a lot of work around leadership. Now, what does that mean? It means bringing people together, expert groups, a lot of technical work, coming up with various platforms, and trying to make sense of the competition between different issues in health. Health is so broad that each disease essentially competes with each other for resources, the latest ones being chronic disease. It's an area that donors don't fund necessarily. We don't do the research in most cases, but we do help to try to shape the agenda scientifically, health systems-wise, but there's a lot of work that really tries to bring people together. I would say that's 80% of the work that we do. A lot of norms and standards. You know, any given technical area has a little book stack of different guidelines, and that's important for developing countries who don't have the capacity of their research institutions or regulatory authorities. Policy options, obviously making sense of this, WHO does contribute to developing some various roadmaps. We do provide technical support, and in a few cases we actually do implementation, notably the eradication programs, polio, guinea worm, some work in leprosy, and also in a variety of other areas, we do a huge amount of technical support at the country level, translating some of these norms into some action. And a lot of our work is around monitoring. It's around data. It's trying to make sense of trends across countries, and you need to use that information as anyone else does, in the sense that it's available on the websites. If you want to know where malaria is, where are you in a country that you're working in compared to others, this is really important for health planning. There's no way around this that you, without that information. But the next step is to take that information to the local level. As WHO, our Director General had six major priorities. Performance has to do with the internal management of the organization. But again, these are very broad themes, and it helps kind of ground you that this is a constantly changing world. If you look at health history, especially in the last 60 years, it's amazing to see the developments and how issues come into more popular treatment and some of those that retreat. One thing that the DG said that is extremely important is that what gets measured gets done. And this is extremely important. Jean Duff mentioned this as well in her opening speech Monday. Seems like a week ago, but it was just 2 days ago. And in this respect, it's extremely important because it does focus energy, whether you're an NGO, an FBO, a government, a local health clinic, or a donor. They all have to kind of measure in order to report back. And in particular, there are two priorities for our Director General. One was the health of women around the world. The other one is the health of people in Africa, which is quite a lot of work. I won't go through this. We're roughly about 8,000 people around the world, but we have 150 country offices. And this is just a quick picture, because for all of you who are working in countries, you have two essential counterparts from WHO, country office and then the regional office. And the regional office are in Washington, Manila, New Delhi, Copenhagen, and Brazzaville in Africa. But at the country office is really a much more practical interaction. We are governed by 193 member states. They come together once a year in May here in Geneva. And then we also have an executive board of 34 of those members. They take the decisions. They negotiate all the language around various instructions. So, and these can get very controversial. I mean, essential medicines and generic drugs and intellectual property. There's all kinds of issues that come up that are very much of the day, you know, and these things change over time. But they also endorse things like global action plans, like non-communicable diseases. They look at a lot of different issues, but they're the ultimate decision maker. And it is quite an interesting process to watch, very much in the UN style, but also very technical. So you have both worlds coming together. In terms of health issues, for context about how organizations partner with each other, and you are living in an extremely diverse world right now, not only in terms of globalization, but in terms of health in particular. When I compare it to education and agriculture, health is a bit more complicated. The inputs are more complicated. The actors are quite more diverse. And the issues are much more diverse. I mean, education has to struggle with schools and teachers and salaries and school books. We're a bit more, even much, much broader than that as a sector, I should say. But these issues come in and out based on the epidemiology. Health security is something we didn't talk about 5 years ago. But because of SARS and avian influenza and now H1N1, but also Ebola, hemorrhagic fevers in West Africa, Nipah virus out of Bangladesh, chikungunya virus coming out of India and showing up in northern Italy, West Nile fever in the United States. These diseases are moving around the world, and some of them are influenced by climate change. That these are issues, and I think the world, including the business world, the political world, are much more sensitive to this issue because of the rapidity of the spread. Who could have imagined that something in Mexico City that no one really knew about could end up halfway around the world in a matter of hours? And that's why I think people are so concerned about H1N1, is that as an influenza virus, you know, a virus is just a virus. It doesn't have much of a brain. And it essentially mutates quite quickly. And that's why people are so concerned about it, is that we know from history that particular virus is something that is very, you know, spread very quickly. We are lucky so far that its severity is somewhat limited, but we just don't know. So there's a lot of looking at these new issues. Imagine 1985 with HIV/AIDS. Some of you, I was in California at the time when it hit, and I remember in Haiti and all the issues that were emerging in those days in Africa, no one knew what it was. It took years to really kind of conclusively determine what was this new virus. It is the natural state of the world, and it is something that clearly is a huge issue. Non-communicable diseases, I think you've already beginning to, people are acknowledging that it's not just an issue of the North, it's an issue of the South. I mean, people are living longer, premature deaths in India and China, in Japan, of course, a developed country, but in Africa as well. And what is the ethics of resource allocation and how do we kind of deal with this? Environmental health, many of you are going to be involved in water and sanitation, but now it's also climate change. Mental health is an issue that often has been at the lesser end of the priority, again, just simply of attention, much more socially and culturally based as well, but let us not forget it. Health systems development, very popular these days, HIV, TB, malaria, maternal and child health, a lot of new drugs coming out in the near future, but who's going to pay for them? And it's an issue for your health system as well, because you're confronted with exactly the same pressures as everyone else. And then, of course, it's all the role of prevention and health promotion and trying to identify a resurgence of the balance between curative care and health promotion. But health, again, is grounded in a much bigger world. It's about globalization. We've seen the new financial crisis, the food crisis. All of these have interactions. Trade and migration. Migration of populations is not just because of conflict. It's also economics. And certainly in the Americas and in Europe, large-scale population movements. And with the European Union expanding, the same issue there. So there are a lot of issues around health there. Population growth, the world continues to grow. There are implications of demography. There are implications of population. Urbanization, climate change, and then finally conflict, that many of you work in conflict areas, which is very, very difficult. Now, what does this have to do with partnering is that each of these communities, each of these sectors have a lot of different partners who work often on health, often not. But how do they come together is really where it all has to happen, particularly at country level. A few words about some of the tensions that we often face, and I think you do as well. We work at a global level, at a regional level. But often WHO as an institution will not get into every single community. And that's where your strength comes in, and many like you, in a sense that at the community levels where people receive health care, not just in rural communities, but urban communities increasingly. And for us, it's how do we work at the different levels, but there are tensions about where actions are taken and where decisions are taken. The Global Fund takes decisions at the global level. Countries apply for the funds, but let's be clear where those decisions are taken. Bilateral agencies will make decisions often at a global level, and then the action is local, but there are a lot of dynamics here. And so here you are working in a community or in a district, and how do you somehow make sense of this kind of very large world of different actors is something that as a system, each system has to think about, is how do they try to see what's going on in the world around them and how to communicate internally to their internal culture and to their own work plans. National and local, we always see this in decentralization. It's a very common issue in many countries. We do see a tension between, historically as well, between infectious and chronic diseases and decisions. We tend to work a lot on the supply side, doctors, nurses, clinics, vaccines, but where are the communities? How do they express their needs? That's something, again, that I think brings us together because we each bring some strengths, and I think the community's voice, and this is where Dr. Carissa Etienne on Monday is really quite passionate about as well, and where many of our regional offices in PAHO and EMRO and elsewhere have done a lot of work trying to figure out how do we get closer to the communities and hear their voice. But it's also a professionalism question. If you're a physician or a nurse, you're not an anthropologist necessarily. And how does one learn and feel comfortable, and how the local health officials feel comfortable? I heard a story recently of a mission out of Swaziland on tuberculosis when people went out into the community and the local responsible officials for tuberculosis in the capital had never been out to their field. So I think there's a lot of issues there that it's not just international, it's even in a given country. Historically, again, a lot of tensions between curative care and population-based public health. We deal in a world of evidence, but in reality, having worked in a government, is that the politics does not always rely on that evidence, so there's always that interchange. We also tend to work heavily with the government. We're a state-oriented institution, but the reality is that non-state providers are providing most of the health care in many, many countries and many communities, including the poor. And I think that's a fundamental issue that we are all trying to come to terms with. Member states and how they each relate, if the country you're working in may have a very open and welcoming approach to working with NGOs and civil society and FBOs and the private sector or not. Sometimes it's extremely conflictual. And there's also a difference between those NGOs in the broadest sense of the word who come indigenously from the country versus the ones that come from outside. And those tensions do exist, and I think many of you have to deal with this on a daily basis, but it does have an influence on how people partner and how one negotiates that, particularly at the national level. And then finally, a lot of groups, both locally and internationally, struggle with this issue of doing the work, but are they recognized? Do they have a voice in the decision-making? Do they have an interface with the national health planning processes? And this is a huge issue that's also currently part of a discussion around the International Health Partnership, and other processes that are trying to improve the national health plans. But if the NGO world, the private sector world, the FBO world is not in the room, it is a bit difficult then to be held accountable for results when you're not there. The only country I know of, at least, and I'm sure my knowledge is not complete on this, is in Kenya, where the National Health Plan of Kenya has targets for public health clinics and targets for the FBO clinics as well. That's a very healthy kind of relationship. It documents who's responsible for what, but it does require some degree of knowledge. Then there's issues of governance and so on. I won't go through this very much, but just to say that there is a proud history in WHO as well. I mean, we've been very involved in smallpox eradication. We've been involved in treaty negotiations like the International Health Regulations and the Framework on Tobacco Convention. We've had two major independent commissions, one on macroeconomics and health, and you've already heard from the social determinants on health most recently. We've been more and more involved in political negotiations around trade, for example, intellectual property. We've had a very good success, frankly, on communicable disease. SARS was controlled quickly in the end of the day. H1N1, we're doing our best. But it's not just us, it's really the countries and how we all work together. Polio has been a success in many parts of the world. We're on the last leg these days. And we're making a lot of progress on guinea worm. We don't talk much about it, but certainly in northern Ghana and southern Sudan, they remain the two areas that still need to be wrapped up. But this is the power of many partners coming together. Polio did not get done by one agency. It was a huge number of groups continuously, Rotary Foundation, CDC, UNICEF, but many NGOs and country level. And again, I think you heard from Jean the other day about the success story of polio and how when you had to deal with an issue of political issues, that how the faith leaders all of a sudden became very important. And UNFPA, our sister agency, is working right now with faith leaders around reproductive health issues as well. It's a very complex world. There are a lot of partnerships out there, a lot of partners, and that leads to fragmentation. So if you're working at a country level, there's a set of issues around who's organizing who exactly, and how do you advance yourselves into an environment that they may not have the door open, but how do you force that door open to allow yourselves in a health community in a country to somehow be part of the table and the community of other actors? And you will never be alone, although I'm sure some of you work at district level probably feel like you're very much alone because there aren't that many providers in the low-resource environments. But nevertheless, there are historically, at least in many countries, it's not even throughout. A lot more foundations becoming active these days in health. That's the good news. New technologies coming out, also good news. I know an issue that's very dear to you is where and how health promotion fits into this is a major issue as well. But essentially, there are a lot of issues still here. Now, this is just a little snapshot. It's not modern art, but it is something that is a kind of very crowded field. Every partnership has an identity, every initiative, every organization. They're all there for the right reasons, but add them all up and you've got a very complex situation, both globally, regionally, locally. And at the country level, this comes from the AIDS world, this is just a quick example of all the different players in an African country who are involved in just HIV/AIDS. And the Ministry of Health is there in the middle. You have got donors, UN agencies. You've got instruments like poverty reduction strategies that the World Bank uses. You've got CCMs, country coordination mechanisms out of the Global Fund, and so on and so forth. And who's out there is that we manage a lot of these advocacy and other kinds of platforms and collaborations. We have a lot of formal partnerships. I won't get into that here. But it is an opportunity for you to think about Stop TB partnership, Rollback Malaria partnership. There are structures for different diseases for which you as an organization, broadly speaking, can participate in. And that's something for the leadership to think about is how and identifying these different partnerships and that you can be a voice in those broader platforms. There are issues around public-private partnerships. There's a lot of new initiatives as well. Making sense out of this is really difficult. But again, this is the kind of thing that corporate offices can help make sense out of, is what does it mean, what does the international health partnership mean, and what's the role for a given country office in those kinds of processes? We work ourselves with a lot of organizations, and one of the values is somehow for us how to hook you into the other UN family, the various other NGO platforms, the FBO platforms, academia, and so on and so forth. And just to make you to scare you a little bit, that's the United Nations. So basically, you have a very diverse, to say the least, set of institutions at country level. And this is why UN reform is such a popular theme among some countries, because it is such a large system and it is very, very difficult to navigate. Now, I want a brief word about the conflict in the humanitarian world. It is a specialized world. It's true in the bilateral agencies, and it is true for us as well. We have a cluster called the Health Action and Crisis Cluster, which is also has chapters of it, if you will, at the regional office and the country office level. But there is an interagency standing committee, and it is there is a network, and it's a very healthy network, of a platform that brings together the Red Cross, World Vision is there, Islamic Relief, MSF. There's no reason that ADRA and yourselves can't be on that as well. And this is a coordination mechanism, and they're called health clusters. WHO runs the health cluster. There's a nutrition cluster. There are many other types of clusters that OCHA and UNHCR and other agencies are involved in. So why do bother partnering? It's awfully a lot of work, and it's awfully sometimes very conflictual. Generally, it's to get something done, and that there needs to be a role for everyone, but everybody works to their comparative advantage. And there needs to be a coordinator in all of this. But ultimately, that joint effort, WHO can't achieve primary health care. It can't achieve the goals of the World Health Resolution. It can just kind of lead and give some advice. But at the end of the day, it's the countries themselves, along with the communities, along with a lot of different partners, that will achieve or not. The concept of scaling up is a huge set of issues. And the joint effort and the collaboration, you know, also takes a lot of time, a huge amount of time, both at country level and globally, to bring people together, sort out who's doing what, get on with it, and then deal with all the other issues. Where are the vaccines coming from? Who's paying for them? Where are the drugs coming from? How do they get into the country? Are there duties? Who's hiring the staff? Are the staff moving back and forth between the government and the non-governmental sectors? There are all kinds of issues there. Again, this issue of decision-making and inclusiveness is a major part of it, and it is a huge issue. But people come together also sometimes for the uniqueness of the task. People are focused on malaria. People are focused on TB. They're focused on maternal mortality. So issues do get divided up by the specific, and we see partnerships for every one of these diseases. We also see partnerships for product development. But there are difficult issues as well that bring people together. When you have a very sensitive political issue, human rights, intellectual property, we do see alliances building around that. Certainly those involved in a lot of these decisions and discussions know this, but it is a reason why people come together. And then most recently, it's about funding. The Global Fund is the best case of this, where you have a whole structure and rules organized to channel money to countries. And as Gene said, there's supposed to be a track and an open track for non-governmental and FBO organizations to access, but this has to be negotiated at the country level. From our side, we need to recognize we can't do this by ourselves, and so we need to engage. We also have a very special role that's a benefit to our partners, that we have access to those member states. That's why they want to partner with us. We obviously have a certain amount of credibility and recognition that we give to the FBOs and to the NGOs, because for them, they need that entry point into the country. And if we have that access, to what extent are we fulfilling our obligations to be the bridge between the non-governmental and the governmental sector? And we do offer a platform for joint planning in any given area, regional office, country office, global levels. We need to advance a broader engagement. But we also provide you a link to other agencies in the UN and a lot of work around monitoring and evaluation. With this comes responsibility of accountability to each other, to the member states, from you to them and from us to them, to the communities themselves, an area that needs a lot of work, I believe. To the funders, obviously anybody who gets money has to report back to those funders, ourselves included. And there's this notion of mutual accountability, and that's still being defined. But the glue that holds us together is trust and clarity of roles. And a monitoring and evaluation framework, Gene put out a challenge for the FBO community, which I believe in as well, which is that we need to document what you're doing. If you don't have that, you are invisible. It is very difficult to negotiate, either for contractual purposes with government or in the broader policy environment, without the data. And the National Health Plan recognition that comes with that. It's that dialogue that allows you to have that. There's a lot of discussion around aid effectiveness and the Paris principles, alignment, harmonization. My simple advice to you is to be familiar with that language. It comes out of the Development Assistance Committee from the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD in Paris, which is a big platform for donors, and mutual accountability issues and so on. Some advice, and I'm about to close on this, is that in a sense, I think it's important for you to think about how do you increase your ties to the national and the local government. There is a political strategy there and a negotiation strategy. Certainly, do try to contact your WHO office. If you're having difficulty there, go to the regional office. Try to get some bridges about trying to enter into a dialogue, at least. You may or may not be receptive. I can't guarantee 100%. Satisfaction is essentially around the world, but it is a work in progress. And I think it's something even culturally we as an institution are trying to change, so we have to give some time to that. Developing linkages with WHO regional offices, same way. Get involved in your country coordination mechanisms at the country level, the UNAIDS country teams, the bilateral donors as well. There is something called the UN country team, maybe very beneficial for you to connect with. There's a real need for alliances around FBOs and NGOs, and an increased professionalism is something a lot of the FBOs themselves are recognizing managerially and technically in the health world, because this is just something that's an evolution of organizations. And then finally, start to become familiar with the health landscape, the actors, the language that's being used, because it's all about language in the end. And there are a lot of challenges with this, understandably, and I think this is my final slide. As you think through the future, what immediate steps, really in the next few months, the next year, can you take to increase your partnering with each other, certainly within the institution, but with the other players, and certainly with WHO? But you have to ask yourself strategically, with whom, and what does it get you, and vice versa? What's required? Every institution needs to survive, period. And in the financial environment the way we are in now, obviously you are asking all of yourselves as a system, and you are a huge system, 90-plus countries, financially, technically, systemically, and politically, how do you build on the base? And you have really charted some new ground for yourselves in this year and into the future and under the leadership of the institution. How to better understand the work where you're working. And then finally, document, document, document. And I think that would really help everyone and really helps to bridge for common understanding. Thank you.